Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 16th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York, to answer your automotive repair questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Always a popular show when Gordon is on. I advise you to get the call in early and get in line. 800-348-2551 is the number. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we try to get to as many emails as we can. Best thing to do is call now, though, and get in the line. 800-348-2551. Car questions today with Gordon Fricke right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The program today all about automotive maintenance and repair. And when we do a question and answer session like that, we always welcome Gordon Fricke back. Gordon is owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive Incorporated in Hoosick Falls, New York. He has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years. And prior to starting his own business in Hoosick Falls, he worked as an automotive tech. You were in Germany.
Yes.
And you were in Massachusetts.
Natick.
Oh, yeah, Natick. Sure, right here, Natick. But that's not the main thing. The Germany is the main thing, and you love the German cars, right?
I have a little soft spot for them, yes.
What'd you drive in today?
Actually, an Audi. Oddly enough, that's German, yeah.
Very nice. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. I always say this when our producer's not around. Full disclosure, I am checking the email. Not that great at it. You can send an email. I'll probably see it, but I might not. Best bet is to call. And again, the number is 800-348-2551. What's new with you, Gordon Fricke?
Well, another hot day. Seems like that's been the pattern this whole summer.
Yeah, it's been kind of wet in spots.
Yeah, and, extremely. Air conditioners are running very hard this year. All the humidity.
Let me ask you a question. I have two vehicles where I have to put, you know, they need a charge. They need an air conditioner charge. In the last 3 weeks, this has happened. I have the gauge and the hose and
the do-it-yourself kit.
You think I can pull it off?
In a lot of cases, you can. If the system has not completely lost all of its refrigerant and you're topping it up, you absolutely can, because there's a little gauge on these new cans where there didn't used to be. And I think the needle will just point to okay or charge, and it gets you pretty close. And I know a lot of people have used them and have gotten their air conditioners spruced back up just because they might have been down a pound of refrigerant or you know, 8-10 ounces. So,
is
yes.
it a dangerous procedure?
No, not really. I mean, if you hook it up correctly, and it's pretty foolproof, follow the instructions, open the valve, or some of them you pull a trigger. And you just watch it until the gauge says good or charge, and then you stop and see what you got.
Okay.
Beyond that, you might have to take it to a shop, you know?
All right. Well, I remember with the Caddies, you had to fool the system because it wouldn't turn the compressor on unless it had some refrigerant in there.
Yes, any cars like that.
If
it's completely empty, there are safety switches that shut the compressor down. And old school, if you didn't have the equipment, you could trip one of the switches, the low pressure switch, to turn the compressor on and drag some refrigerant in.
So that's what we did.
Yeah, that's what you were talking about.
All right, our number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. The phone lines are loading up here, so let's get right to the calls. Stephen in Cornwall. Stephen, you're first. That's an inauspicious start. Do you want to try it again? Oh, your connection's bad. Tell you what, Stephen, we'll put you on hold. Maybe you'll be in a better spot. I hung up on him. Well, call again, Stephen. I apologize. Sonia in the Berkshires. Sonia, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Hey, Gordon. I'm glad you like VWs, because here's my situation. I have a 1982 VW Vanagon that I love, but it's a diesel, and when I bought it, it had an oil leak. It still has an oil leak. I brought it to one person to correct the oil leak, and it still leaks. And my question is this. People have told me there's this stuff you can buy to, I guess, kind of plug up an oil leak in a vehicle. First of all, does that work? And second of all, should I even be thinking about that for a 1982 Vanagon?
Yeah, that's a rare vehicle. That diesel option was only available 1 or 2 years. So you've got a rare vehicle. And that diesel engine was derived from the cars, from the Rabbits and the Dashers, I guess, of that era, or maybe they were called Quantums or whatever. So it all depends on where your engine is leaking oil, and it sounds as though you have had trouble getting somebody to pinpoint the source of the leak.
I had somebody tell me it was the head gasket, and that he replaced it. Found out later he never really replaced it, so I'm not really sure if that was ever the problem, but that's where he said it was, head gasket. Most people can't figure it out.
That vintage diesel engine had a fair amount of head gasket leak issues. It was not uncommon at all. In those days, we used to replace a lot of them. And if that's the case, it's extremely unlikely that anything you pour in the oil is going to calm that down, because that is a pressurized leak. If it is leaking past one of the rubber seals, which there's one on each end of the crankshaft, some of those additives may help to get those seals in better shape and possibly help them seal up the crank a little bit better. It's not harmful to try a dose. Don't overdo it. But if it is a head gasket leaking, this stuff won't help it, because, like I said, it's under pressure, and it won't solve that issue at all.
My other question is this. Do you know of anybody within the tri-state area that could work on this thing?
I haven't seen those in decades, and I'm really not geared up for much of those older diesels, because there were some special tools involved. So I don't know, to be honest with you. I can't tell you who might handle those.
All right, Sonia, good luck.
Thank you.
The Vanagon, I'm trying to remember now. That was kind of an underpowered van, right?
Well, so you had the Volkswagen bus with the split windows.
Right.
You see the one that I have in my showroom,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. We saw one up in Maine, too. Fantastic. It had the thing on the top that opened up.
Nice.
Where you could sleep in there?
The pop top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's the first generation with the split window. Next generation was a curved front glass called a bay window. The next generation was the Vanagon, which is what our last caller was talking about. So it's a little bit squarer and boxier.
Yeah, I remember.
They developed a liquid-cooled engine for them, so they improved, I guess, each generation.
All right. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we talk car and truck repair today. The number is 800-348-2551. Paul in Germantown is on. Paul.
Hi. I have a 2008 Volkswagen Passat with a front-wheel drive, four-cylinder engine, and I have a wheel noise that I don't know how to diagnose. So it's a vibration noise, and it sounded like it was coming from the back. So I jacked up the back and spun the wheels and dusted them off, and it seemed normal to me. They spun fine, and I realized I should probably do that from the front, but I don't know what I'm looking for.
Yeah. So do you feel this vibration in the steering wheel when it's happening?
I don't.
You don't. Okay. If you bear through turns, through curves, what speed do you hear it the most at?
It's almost at all speeds, but when I do turn left, it goes away.
Yeah. So what you're describing usually is a front wheel bearing issue, because when you go through curves, it completely changes the load on the front bearings. It's more side load, and it lifts some weight off of the inside wheel. So you more than likely have a front wheel bearing going. And you tell me the noise.
If I jack up the front and spin it by hand, will I notice something that should?
Maybe.
It would be out of place?
Maybe, because you're going to have a harder time spinning the front wheels because you're turning the axles and you're going into the transmission. And you got to turn them at a fairly good speed. But this is what I would do. Is grab the wheel at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, in other words, top and bottom, and see if there's any free play in the wheel, as if the wheel's ready to fall off. Because if the bearing...
Well, the front end's up in the air.
Yeah, when you're jacked up and, safely supported. Just make sure there isn't excessive play, because the bearing will eventually fail and the wheel could come quite loose. So check that out, but that's what I think you got happening there.
That sounds right. In a short amount of time, the noise has gotten worse,
Don't ignore that noise, because it's telling you it's time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should I look into doing this work myself if I'm a little handy, or
tell me the year of the car again.
2008.
I think a 2008 may have a bolt-in bearing assembly rather than a press-in. The bolt-in, you might be able to handle yourself if you're handy and clever. The press-in ones are a lot of work, and they have to go to a shop where they can do press work. So,
And I
can't remember when they switched all of those over, but I'm not sure on that year.
All right, Paul. Hey, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks for your help.
Bye now. 800-348-2551, the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and Lynn in Rexford is on. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a 2009 Audi A4. The thermostat is stuck in the open position at the moment, which I guess is the right place for it to be stuck. But I'm wondering, I've been told to replace that, to get that fixed, and then have the belt and the water pump done at the same time. And I'm trying to figure out if there's any kind of a magic eight ball to say whether that's worth it on a car with 116,000 miles.
Sure. It's an 09?
09.
So it's an A4. And let me think here. An 09 A4, I believe, has a timing chain. Were they talking about it doing a timing chain or a water pump?
Yes, I'm sorry. The water pump and a timing chain.
Okay, the chain is not necessary to change at any interval. And that's a mess.
Okay.
That's a major, major job, which you don't have to routinely do. So in the case of your car, really, unless there's any issue with the water pump being loose or leaking, really all you need to do is get the thermostat itself changed. And if it's turning on your check engine light for a code, it's called cooling system efficiency, you should also have the temperature sensor replaced together with the thermostat, because the two work together to tell your computer what the temperature is and to provide the right temperature hot water for the engine. So do both of those, but I don't think I'd be doing the pump unless there's a problem with it.
Okay.
All right, Lynn.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We have to take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here with Gordon Fricke, and we answer your automotive questions today, and our number is 800-348-2551. Before we go back to the phones, a few emails here to tackle. This one's from Steven in Pittsfield. My check engine light goes off and on periodically and has for 2 years. A quick diagnostic pointed to the oxygen sensor. Is there any negative consequence to ignoring this?
Well, it depends on which one. Cars have more than one oxygen sensor. The rearmost one behind the catalytic converter is the catalyst monitor, and it keeps track of how well the emission system is working. And on most cars, that one doesn't affect drivability. So in that case, he probably could not do anything about it.
Until inspection.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a front one, you may develop running problems, and that could be an issue.
Okay, this one is from Holly. I have a 2010 Hyundai Accent standard transmission. About a month ago, ticking started under the hood, but stops when the clutch is engaged. 2 weeks ago, the ticking got much louder. Still, it stops when the clutch is engaged. This week, it became difficult to shift to first, and when I did, it was a bit clunky, so now I start from second. I have a repair appointment tomorrow, but would love some insight as to what it is and what I should expect to pay. And that's from Holly.
Sounds not like it could be bad.
Oh, boy.
I'm thinking clutch.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
that's probably what all the ticking was.
Right.
And that's why she can't probably operate first gear anymore, possibly. So starting out in second is going to be even worse for the clutch.
You betcha.
So clutches are expensive now.
Really?
So, yeah.
Even in a Hyundai?
Yeah, you could be, depending if the flywheel is ruined, which it probably is. I've seen some clutches go anywhere from $800 to $1,500, depending on the car.
Not really worth it for a 2010 Hyundai, huh?
Well, depends on how good the car is, you know?
Yeah, I suppose. This one's from Jason, who writes, I was wondering, I have an issue with my 1999 Chrysler Sebring convertible JXI. The engine light code, P0551 for the power steering. I have emissions coming up. I can't get the engine light to stay off. I keep resetting it. It comes on after 5 miles. My mechanic has replaced everything from the power steering pump to the power steering pressure sensor switch. He said it may be a computer chip issue, and to bring it to Chrysler, which may be expensive. Is there anything I can do to try and avoid taking it to the dealer because it could be expensive? That's
from
Jason.
Yeah, some of these codes maybe are a little bit of a fringe having to do with emissions. Some transmission codes, he's got a steering code. You wonder how that correlates into emissions issues, but if his shop has exhausted everything they can do, it is possible that there is a glitch in the software that may have been required some updates over the years that the car never got.
Yeah.
So, yes, call a dealer with that issue.
That would not be expensive.
May or may not.
Software update,
no,
right?
Not a big deal. No.
This one, and it's a shame that you can't do these software updates yourself.
Well, you can, if you have advanced diagnostic equipment and you buy the packages, you can do some of them, you know, shops like me, but you got to invest quite a bit in that stuff.
This one is from Monique in Lake Hill. I recently hit a large hole in the road going around 45 miles per hour. A few days later, I noticed a constant clunking sound under the front end, and it also sounds like something else is loose and sort of rattling. Do you think there's a connection? What could the clunking be?
Well, maybe a bent wheel, if the hole was that severe, and that every time that bent part of the wheel comes around, it makes a thumping sound, or it developed a injury or a bad spot in the tire. So do not ignore that thumping if it occurred after that pothole. Get it checked.
All right, this one is from Mark. I have just had a rebuilt transmission installed into my car. It is a 2005 V6 engine Honda Accord. The car has about 175,000 miles on it. Now that I have a rebuilt transmission, should I baby this new tranny? For example, should I flush the fluid more frequently than normal?
Well, I would continue maintaining it as the manual prescribes. So, yes, if it says do a fluid flush at 30,000 miles, certainly do it. Should you overdo it? Well, not really.
Okay. Back to the phones, and let's go to John in Stockbridge. John, you're on.
Hi, Ray and Gordon. I've been waiting for this for a while.
Okay.
I have an older German vehicle, and my question is about the octane rating. I have the owner's manual, which suggests a 95-plus octane rating, so I can't get that at the pump, obviously, so sometimes I put an additive in it, which makes the car perform night and day different. Why is an octane rating make the like, what's the correlation between octane rating and performance? Like, why does it perform so much better with a higher octane rating?
Sure. What is the car? What kind of car are we talking about?
It's Porsche 1988 928 S.
Yep. Okay. So the octane rating you're referring to is European. And when it says 95, you can't get 95 in the U.S. It's a different way of measuring the octane. So.
Of course.
93 is more than adequate for that car.
Okay.
And the reason the octane improves performance is what they did is the compression of the engine has been increased, especially on European cars of your vintage. And then there are knock sensors installed that listen for pinging or knocking noises due to lower octane gasoline. So the computer compensates for the poor octane gas, doesn't harm the engine, you don't hear all the noises, but you lose power. So when the engine receives the highest octane fuel, the computer strives to increase the ignition timing and sharpen all of your engine management parameters to the highest performance. Mm. And that's why you say, gee, the car runs better on 91 or 93 versus 87. So, yes, in a performance car like yours, you can feel it. Some cars, you never know the difference.
Now, I've been putting super unleaded, plus I put an additive lots of times, it says it increases the octane rating.
Yeah.
Let alone from putting, like, a VP racing fluid that would make it run a lot faster, I guess. But what should I do? Does that harm the engine every time I add an additive, like say an octane booster to the gas?
No,
because it drives so much better. So should I keep doing it? I mean, it's a great expense, but should I keep doing it?
Well, your engine is only going to increase its potential to a certain point. The computer's got parameters, And if you put 93 octane, top tier gas, good brand of gasoline, 93 octane with all the detergents, that's all that engine needs. I don't think you would boost your performance by adding octane booster to it. I don't think the computer is going to take it beyond that. But
he said he felt a difference when he added the additive.
And the throttle response, everything they put the additive in it is night and day from a full tank of just plain 93.
Yeah, so, as long as you don't overuse the additive, put more in than is recommended, I don't think it's going to harm anything.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks, John. We appreciate your call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest today on the program. Who has been waiting the longest? It looks like it's Bruce in Albany. Bruce, you're on.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for the show. I really appreciate it. And just a little bit of background. I've been in the automotive industry, not on the repair side, but on the manufacturer side for over 30 years, and I wanted to compliment Gordon on his knowledge and his advice.
Nice.
After being around that long, I've run across a few guys who are the old square peg in the round hole, and Gordon is 180 degrees at all of his advice. Everything that I've learned over the years, it matches up to what he says, so it's nice to hear somebody on the radio giving good advice.
Wow, that's great to hear.
Thank you very much.
But on the other hand...
Oh, here we go. The shoe's about to drop, Gordon.
There you go. No, well, I think it was on your last show you were talking about brakes with somebody and they were having a pulsation issue.
Yep.
And you said in the manufacturer's world, the word warped is... we don't like that word. So I'm just wondering, you know, warped rotors is... I guess it's a contentious issue in the repair industry. But on the manufacturer's side, they would rather talk about lateral runout and things like that.
Yeah.
So I just want to clarify what your stance is on that.
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Out of true or lateral runout is more technical, of course. To the layman, if they picture something as warped, they can see that it's wavy, and that might translate into feedback in your brake pedal giving you that pulsation. But, yeah, of course, it's thickness variation and run out, sure.
Right, okay. Yep. I kind of knew you knew that, but I just, you know, people think that, you know, if they get their brakes hot and then run through a puddle, that they're going to warp the rotors and things like that, you know, and blame it on the metallurgy rather than on other issues that are involved with the braking system, and I just kind of wanted to clarify that.
Sure.
Well, thank you for going easy on us, Gordon.
Yeah.
We appreciate it. Honestly,
99.9% of the time when you give an answer, I am overjoyed because it's so nice to hear what's really going on with vehicles rather than the, you know, myths that you find like on YouTube and things like that.
Yep. Well, you make a point about that. Hey, Bruce, thanks for the call very much. It's 800-348-2551. We go over to Carlos in Albany. Carlos.
Hey there. I had a question about a 2012 VW Golf. Mm-hmm. It's been throwing this check engine code, a P0106. I understand through my research it could be a map sensor, and there could be lots of reasons for it, but it's consistent with highway driving. It only comes on after I've been driving several hours on the highway, and then once I get back to city driving, the code will go away and reset itself. So I was wondering maybe you could help me narrow it down to maybe a certain cause.
So did you have that scanned somewhere?
I just have one of those little code readers you buy at the auto store, and just said P0106 and just looked on Google there.
Yeah. So what was your description of the code? What did you find it as being again?
It indicated it could be map sensor, but then I understand it could not necessarily be the sensor, but something in correlation with it.
Yeah. Sometimes the code, when you read the codes, it doesn't necessarily mean that the component that becomes in question is the fault. So testing has to occur, and a lot of times in cases like map sensors or mass airflow sensors, it can be other things. Dirt on the mass airflow example can cause that trouble, a severely clogged air filter, various vacuum leaks. So I wouldn't just go and buy a sensor and replace it unless it was inexpensive and an easy experiment. And if your code only happens once in a while, being intermittent, you may want to see if it turns into a hard code and stays on there more consistently.
I was just wondering if, because it's consistently with highway driving.
Yeah.
But as soon as I get back to city driving, the code goes away. So I was hoping that might narrow it down to maybe if it's actually a sensor or a specific component that works with the sensor, that might be the issue.
It could be any of those. That's the problem today. Everything's interrelated. And there's, you know, there's a loop of information going on in cars. Computers are talking to each other. So I hate to just go out and say, go ahead and replace XYZ. Sometimes
right.
that solves it yeah. entirely. Other times. But in your case, I don't think I would do that yet.
All right.
All right.
Well, appreciate that. You have yourself a nice day.
Thanks, Carlos. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, the guest, and Harold and Rhinebeck is next. Harold, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a Nissan Sentra 2006, and when I go over a bump, pothole, even a crack in the road, I get quite a jarring kind of, I feel it for a couple of seconds. The car's bouncing. I was told by a couple of mechanics, they thought it was mechanics that I think I trust. They thought it was rear struts. It's a Nissan Sentra, and I believe it's struts in the back, shocks in the front, and they thought it was the rear struts that were shot. And I know somebody, well, I don't know if you bounce, I don't know if it's much of a test, but if you bounce on the trunk, it sort of keeps going, if that
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good test.
Yes, and I guess I wasn't quite sure what I was asking, except what the cost of something like that tends to be. Assuming it's correct, or maybe you have another suggestion. I mean, I could probably use a couple tires, but I don't think bad tires would make it bounce that much.
Yeah, now you probably are talking about shock or strut issues.
Yes.
And that is a good test. If you cars used to have larger bumpers where you could actually push up and down on them, but if you can jounce the back of the car and then let go and see if it keeps bouncing a few times, it really shouldn't rebound much at all.
Okay.
If it's bouncing three or four times, you definitely have a shock absorber issue. Do the same with the front of the car. And then I would just, to get pricing, you really should get it looked at because there could be other components that need to get changed at that same time.
Yeah, okay. Harold, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551, the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest today, and Ed in Sharon, Connecticut is next. Ed.
Hello. I have two Volkswagen Vanagons, and if it's all right, I have a mechanic in the area that I could recommend to you earlier.
I think that's a nice idea, but I really don't. We can't really do that over the radio, but thank you, Ed. We appreciate it very much. Over to Josh in Wilmington. Josh, you're on.
Hey, how are you? I've got a 2008 Volkswagen Passat 6-speed manual 2-liter turbo. And my check engine light came on, and the code turned out to be a misfire in number one cylinder. And after doing some research online, I find out that I have probably carbon buildup on the intake valves. And because the car is a direct check part, they tell me there's nothing that can be done except pull the intake manifold off and manually spray it. So I tried using seafoam. I went to the dealer, and they tried a Pennzoil product that they dripped in slowly over half an hour while the engine was revving at 2,000. Wondering, is there anything I can do besides actually removing the intake manifold and having someone scrape that manually off?
Yeah. So if it's been determined, and you really don't 100% know it's a carbon issue until you take a look, but yes, this is a common problem with direct injected engines.
Actually, the dealer used a fiber optic scope, and he shoved it in there and showed me the carbon buildup.
Yeah, yeah. It's not uncommon. How many miles are on this car now?
$150,000.
Yeah. The only remedy to get that carbon cleaned is intake manifold removal and physical cleaning. And the dealers have a carbon blast set up where a machine sprays pulverized walnut shells in there. And that does a fantastic job.
Pulverized walnut shells.
Walnut shells is the medium, or media, I guess is the term.
Yeah.
Instead of sand.
I use that for cat litter.
But
well, there you go.
But then if yours is very carboned up, you will be amazed at how nicely that engine performs after you get this clean.
All right, Josh, we have to take a break. Our guest is Gordon Fricke. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Hello again. Welcome back to the program. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Gordon Fricke is our guest today. And we'll get back to the phones in a moment. This one came in via email from Kathy in Albany. And Kathy writes, do you feel that automakers don't size the air conditioning properly for their vehicles or volume of glass? We always have trouble keeping the cab cool enough on hot days without keeping the AC cranked to the max. Then the noise pollution prevents me from hearing you today on Vox Pop. And that's from Kathy.
Yeah, that's interesting because some vehicles... And I drive a bunch of vehicles for test drives throughout the week.
Yeah.
And some cars cool way better than others. And I think the systems sometimes get heavily designed or you know, they're robust for the car, and others are on the brink of not being able to keep the car cold. So
yeah.
She's absolutely right.
Okay. This one is from Gary in Albany. Gordon, I own a 2006 Jeep Wrangler with a strong front end wobble between 50 and 55 miles per hour. I replaced the ball joints and steering stabilizer about a year ago, and the 245/75R16 tires are worn, but only have about 20,000 miles on them. Would a four-wheel alignment help, or any other ideas on how to correct it?
Yeah, remember we had a caller a couple of shows ago about the death wobble
yep.
on a Jeep?
Yep.
An overlooked component is called the track bar, and that holds the front axle basically in place with the frame.
Mm-hmm.
So that track bar needs to be very carefully checked. And if he's having tire wear issues, yes, definitely an alignment needs to be looked at.
All right, over to Ben in Albany. Ben, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling because I have my tires. I got them about 2 years ago. And on one of them, I noticed about a year and a half ago, there's like a round bump about the size of a nickel in the sidewall of one of them. It's been going for about a year and a half, and I keep meaning to take it in to see if it's a problem, but not getting around to it. I haven't been too worried up to now because my commute is mostly back roads, so, you know, not too risky. But before I take it on the highway for a long trip, is that something I should be concerned about, or is that something that happens?
So it's a bubble that's protruding. It's an Audi, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That can't be good.
No. When they make tires, that when they put the tire together, there is a little bit of what's called an undulation that actually curves slightly in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. But anything that's protruding out should definitely be looked at. It's not good. It generally is from a pothole or some type of impact that broke one or two or three or four of the strands of the radial plies that go from bead to bead. And that's letting the rubber swell out. It's kind of ballooning out. And that could be dangerous. So, yes.
Pop, maybe. Eh?
Well, it definitely needs to be looked at. I wouldn't be driving too long without getting some professional eyes on that tire.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Over to Steve in South Cambridge. Steve, you're on.
Good afternoon. You two guys are the best team on radio. Oh,
thank you.
Oh, that's great.
My question is a general one about ground because I really don't understand the physics behind it. I rewired a boat trailer yesterday for a customer, and I got everything working except the tail light on the passenger side. And then by sheer coincidence, I realized it was a ground problem. So I fixed that. Everything works now. But it's a typical tail light with two elements in it. So how come the ground was good for for my flashers and my directionals and my brake lights, but it wasn't good enough for my taillight.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, trailers are notorious for ground problems.
Yes, they are.
They really are. I have a snowmobile trailer, and every now and then I got lights that aren't working properly, and I've got to clean and grind and make new ground connections because everything goes through a common the framework of the trailer and grounds to the goes up through to the connector and grounds inside to the car or the truck. Is that taillight assembly bolted on, and is that where all your light grounds are occurring, where it bolts to the frame of the trailer?
It bolts to the frame of the trailer.
Yep.
But again, everything else worked except this one feature.
Hmm. It's possible. Is it a socket issue? Are these the original taillights, or did you put new lights
brand
on?
Brand new as of yesterday.
Okay. I would be suspicious just to look inside those sockets to be sure that the that they're being grounded correctly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of imported components now from overseas.
Yeah.
Do you want to name any countries? These had metric threads on them.
Yeah. I'm not going to mention any countries or
right.
oceans, but you know, the quality of some of the stuff we're getting is questionable, and you have to be concerned with how stuff was manufactured sometimes, because you can get a lot of defective parts.
What I was wondering as my theory was the brighter ones, the directionals and everything.
Yep.
Could they have been using the taillight feed as its ground?
Yeah, they can. They can borrow ground from their cousin next door.
Right, but so the taillight couldn't borrow the ground the other way.
It's possible.
Because of the way it's probably put together.
Yeah, because a lot of times if you lost a ground on one light, like a directional,
yep.
wrong lights will flash. You'll say, how could that be happening? Yeah. Well, they're searching out a ground through a different source and getting it through the bulb elements and going backwards.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yep. Interesting.
Yep.
Okay. Wonderful.
All right.
Well, I'll sleep better tonight.
All right.
Well, good luck, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call. Over to Doug in Canaan, New York. Doug, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I have a 2006 Mercedes sedan E350 4MATIC, and I love it. I've had it for 11 years now. Bought it pre-owned. But in the last handful of years, it seems like with a lot of cars, of course, today it's a check engine problem. But I have a guy I trust a lot here and I've gone to for lots of lesser work, and he seems a little shy about this. He's done a number of things to check what the problem is, but it keeps popping back on. About a month ago, I started noticing it flashing, and he said, well, that's when it's really a problem, you know, and it started, you know, the engine, the car was sort of whoop-whooping. It's the only way I can think to describe it, you know. And so he got in there and he tried a couple of things. I'm not real car conversant that he thought they might be. It turned out they weren't. Now what he seems to be zeroing in on, and he seems a little reluctant to do it, is he said, you're going to have to take the whole top end of the engine off. And there are some cam chains or something.
Oh,
and he
boy.
Said it's probably the furthest chain. And he seemed like that's a real job, he said, you know.
Yes.
And I might be better off going to the dealer, which I try to avoid because dealers, you know. But is this something that I might have to do or, you know.
What
do
is
you think
the...
it's better? Go ahead. Sorry.
How many miles are on the car now?
About 150,000, 160.
Cam chain issues and cam timing issues are all too common now with higher mileage mm-hmm. engines. There's so much movement going on in the valve train now. Variable cam timing. Some vehicles will also change the how far open the valves will go, and lack of or not frequent enough oil changes have a great bearing on that. But yes, if he thinks
I'm pretty good on that.
Yeah, it sounds like you probably are. If he thinks you've got a cam timing chain issue, that is very complicated technical work, and
right.
you probably would want to talk to a dealer, but be prepared for a pretty massive price.
You have to take the top of the engine off.
Well,
so that's hour.
You've got the front of the engine to come off. You got on some cars, one of the chains runs on the back, one runs on the front on some Ford V6s. And then you're susceptible. There's a lot of oil leak potential there. So it's a big, big job for sure. Yeah.
So we're talking like thousands.
It could very well be. Yeah, it's awful. Yep.
Sorry, Doug.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Maybe you should get a second opinion. I think that's probably a good, because maybe it's not that.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe it's a fuse or some WD-40 will fix it, right?
Or a can of additive in the gas tank. You never know.
Yeah, but it never is that simple, is it? Well, sometimes it is. Steve in Schoharie. Steve, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Looking at a vehicle, about a 2000 Volvo XC70 all-wheel or four-wheel drive wagon, five-cylinder. Do you have any history with those vehicles and things I should be looking for?
Yeah, they were a very, very good rugged car. How many miles are on this vehicle?
About 120, I think, something like that.
It's pretty low for that age car.
And he said it's really immaculate, and it looks great. The older guy owned it, and sounds great, like beautiful story online, but when I get there, I don't know what I'll find.
Yeah. Right.
Now, a lot of times that's exactly true. Those cars tend to sometimes have good owners, and they take extremely good care of them. That vintage did suffer from some automatic transmission issues. Doesn't mean you have one or that's one of them, but right. Up until I think 04, there were some automatic problems with them.
Okay.
Durable car. They were very resistant to rust and corrosion. I would not be afraid to pursue that car. And I'm sure it's not going to be that expensive. It's old enough to where it's, the value is pretty low.
No, the deal, the price is really good. And I just wanted to have a heads up before I go take it for a drive, talk to the guy for the first time. And,
yeah. Key in on how it's shifting, how the transmission feels, and maybe ask the owner if the transmission has been serviced at whatever intervals it might be necessary. I don't think it's a giant risk.
All right, Steve, good luck. And over to Mike in Rosendale. Mike, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I have a 2005 Honda Odyssey. We just bought the car about 2 weeks ago from a used dealer, and everything was working fine. But now the door latch seems to be getting stuck. We can't open it from the outside or the inside. Every once in a while, we will drive over a bump. And it works. And then, we hit another bump and it stops working. I took the latch assembly out and everything seems to be working okay. But I did notice that the release cable seems a little hard to pull. I'm just wondering if you think that it's, I need to replace the whole latch assembly, or it might just be as simple as just replacing the release cable.
What door are we talking about?
I'm sorry, it's the driver's side door.
The driver's door, okay, yeah. Of course, that door gets the most use, and that tends to wear out the fastest. Today, your latches are pretty well unitized. Everything's in the latch. The lock-unlock mechanism, it's power locks. That actuator's built in there. Then you have a cable going up to the handle. And I have found, I've tried to lube them and do different things. A lot of times you end up having to replace the latch entirely, and that may be what you're up against. So, yes, that could be the answer to your issue. As long as the cable's not pulling super tight and it's on the brink of opening all the time,
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Gordon Fricke is our guest today, and here in the waning moments, we'll try to get to as many calls as we can. And we go to Suzanne in Kingston. Suzanne.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a 2006 CRV, which 2 weeks ago I had the front driver's side axle replaced. When I drove it out of the parking lot at the shop, at the lower edge of the gears, I was noticing a wobble. And so it went back in today. They replaced the axle again because they thought, well, it was a bad axle that they put in. Then they did a number of other things. They rotated the tires because they were still feeling the wobble. They rotated the tires. They balanced the tires. And when I took it out, they were saying they still felt it, and they thought maybe they didn't know what could be next.
Yeah.
I just drove it home. I don't feel the wobble.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what your take on this would be, Gordon.
Yep. Yeah, it's very common. It is the drive axle almost always, and it is, again, The
Could it be connected to the power rack? Because I do have a leak in the steering fluid.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I've experienced this lots of times, and it has to do with the quality of the overseas part that was put on your car, which sometimes we have very little choice over now because
right.
going factory is so expensive. But these drive axles are mass-produced. I mean mass-produced somewhere across the Pacific Ocean. And the quality of the parts is just relatively poor. And you can get better ones than others. And probably the second one they put in the vehicle was of better quality, just, quote, run-of-the-mill.
But the odd part is that they're saying they can feel the wobble. I drove it out, and I'm thinking, okay,
right.
and I can't feel it. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe I'm good.
You are good in that respect because they're mechanics, and they are accelerating harder to try to feel the problem,
right.
and they're making it come out at
yeah.
higher loads.
Okay.
You're driving the car much more gently than they are,
yeah.
and you're not feeling it.
Yes.
It may not change.
Hmm.
So I think I would just, if it's not affecting the way you drive, I think you're going to be
no.
okay. And
yeah.
just keep all your paperwork because some of those drive axles have a good warranty. So let's say it starts wobbling where you're dissatisfied in a year and a half or 2 years. You know, you have the opportunity maybe to get another one.
All right, Suzanne, thank you very much. We'll quickly go over to Mike in Bennington, Vermont. Mike, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking me at the end. A couple quick questions about an 09 Audi A4 2-liter. I'm having to add a quart of oil every 1,600 miles, and I'm told that's normal for that car. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's pretty close to true. A couple of things on that car that will affect that oil consumption. All cars today have lower resistance piston rings to get better gas mileage, make the engine run more freely. But the downside is, or the side effect is, they start to use some oil. If you're using a quart to 1,000 or a quart to 1,500, that's not crazy. But anyway, on the top of your engine, under that plastic cover, there is a what Audi calls an oil separator. U.S. car companies used to call it a PCV valve. They've updated that several times on your engine. Take the part number from it, call a dealer, see if you've got the latest version of that oil separator.
Ah.
Because that will, they're trying to keep those things on the happy medium to not use more oil than people like to have.
All right.
So that would be it.
We'll have to leave it there. Gordon Fricke, thank you for being here, sir. Support comes from the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate liberal arts theater program with concentrations in design, technology, theater studies, and performance, newpaltz.edu/theater. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries, georgepropane.com. Albany Distilling Bar and Bottle Shop, 75 Livingston Avenue, featuring an array of locally produced beverages, plus a patio and event room, announcing new barrel loan program, albanydistilling.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy, and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY Eyewear, albany.com. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke for stopping by today. Thank you for listening and for the calls and emails. Thanks to Dina Salzman, who took the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the father-daughter team of Mohammed and Anissa Wahid return with Indian and Moroccan dishes. Right now, stand by for news.